Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Went beneath the world's oceans to discover what has happened to the millions of tons of chemical weapons that have been dumped in the sea since the early 20th century. Now, as we have entered the 21st century and forgotten the days of the war, real time bombs are ticking.
Well, starvation in the besieged Gaza Strip continues to take the lives of vulnerable Palestinians. An infant and a young girl are the latest victims, as Israel blocks aid trucks trying to enter the coastal territory. Gaza's health ministry says a two-month-old girl died in Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza, and a 20-year-old girl in Al-Shifa Medical Complex in the same region. This brings the official death toll from malnutrition and dehydration to 25. The ministry estimates that dozens die silently without reaching hospitals. It says the latest deaths prove that the famine in northern Gaza has reached lethal levels. The Gaza Strip, especially the northern region, is grappling with severe shortages in food, water, medication, and fuel. Thousands of Israeli protesters have once again rallied in Tel Aviv, demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. At least 10 protesters were detained after clashing with the regime forces, who used tear gas and water cannon to disperse the demonstrators. Protesters call for an immediate ceasefire in Israel's ongoing onslaught on Gaza and the return of the captives being held by Palestinian resistance groups. They criticized Netanyahu's handling of the war in Gaza and demanded new elections. They also called on U.S. President Joe Biden to stop supporting Netanyahu. Four Palestinian protesters have held yet another demonstration in the Canadian city of Calgary against the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. Protesters waved Palestinian flags and shouted slogans in support of Gazans. They denounced the West, particularly the U.S., for its complicity in the Israeli genocide, saying that the regime cannot continue its crimes without such support. Protesters also called for an immediate ceasefire in the Palestinian territory. Since the beginning of the regime's onslaught on Gaza, Canadians have staged several rallies in support of Palestinians. Similar rallies have also been held in several other countries across the world.
More than 5 months of major demonstrations, and they're as energized as ever. Hundreds of thousands of pro-Palestinian protesters from across the UK marching to the American embassy to deliver a message.
Shame on you, Joe Biden, shame on you.
That message is much for the US president as for the UK government.
The majority of people want a ceasefire now, and it's not even a big ask. What are they asking? For humanity and stop killing innocent children and people.
On the stage near the American embassy, Welsh singer Charlotte Church combines Welsh and Arabic words for a song of solidarity, followed by an all-woman cast of speakers marking the International Women's Day and the resilience of Palestinian women. As ever, it's an eclectic mix of groups and organizations, out in great numbers in defiance of attempts by the government to criminalize these overwhelmingly peaceful demonstrations.
We're here to say to the government that we aren't going to be stopped. These aren't hate marches. And we have Jewish blocks, we have Jewish people who march with us in solidarity and who march with us and say, not in their name.
The war on Gaza and the UK's support for it has deeply polarized British society. And that's already manifesting itself in the way people are voting. A case in point, the by-elections in Rochdale, Greater Manchester in late February, which handed veteran pro-Palestine campaigner George Galloway of the Workers' Party of Britain a landslide victory against the major party candidates.
But we know there's a whole body of people for whom issues of international justice and rights and Britain's position in the world and whether it shows respect for human rights and international law matter. And there are certain constituencies where the issue of does Britain support and protect the rights of the Palestinian people is of particular resonance.
This was the fifth national demonstration of the year, and organizers say there will be more.
While the civilians in Gaza say they feel that their plight is being ignored, the millions of people here and around the world are saying that they are making sure through their protests that the Palestinians know that their cries are being heard. Saipur is up, London.
If there was any concern that pro-Palestinians in France were starting to lose interest in the five-month-long attempted genocide of Gaza by Israel, one of the nation's largest demonstrations since the start of the invasion put that idea to rest. Many thousands converged in the capital for a passionate denunciation of President Emmanuel Macron, the leaders of the Pan-European Project, and all of Israel's war supporters across the West.
If France must stay in Europe, then Europe must respect our demands, and we demand that they stop protecting the terrorist state of Israel. Hamas is not a terrorist group. They are a resistance group, and the United Nations refuse to label them terrorists. Palestinians have the right to resist, to exist, and to be free.
In what many say is an illustration of the West's deadly hypocrisy, at least five children were killed by airdropped food aid from Western nations and their allies.
This week, more than 200 members of European Union Parliament called for an arms embargo on Israel. They said that by remaining silent on Gaza, Europe has no credibility to speak on Russia's actions in Ukraine. Germany now provides 28% of Israel's military imports.
Israeli settler attacks in the West Bank have almost tripled since October to 9 per day. Israeli troops continue to open fire on starving Palestinians seeking food aid and also on United Nations troops in Lebanon. Some 31,000 Gazans have been killed and over 72,000 Gazans wounded, all leaving marchers in disbelief that the West continues to support Israel without conditions or consequences.
It's scandalous. France is charged with defending international law, and it even has a United Nations Council veto to do so, but it only defends Israel instead. I am not asking France to bomb Tel Aviv. I am asking them to uphold humanity's laws with very simple sanctions that could be put in place on Tel Aviv immediately.
Even with the holy month of Ramadan starting next week, Israel has rejected yet another plan for a ceasefire. Many say it's a new low for Tel Aviv.
One must respect the humanity of others, and normally during Ramadan there's a ceasefire to allow people to live their religion in peace. And yet Israel wants to keep murdering babies by starvation during Ramadan. It's scandalous and unacceptable. There must be a ceasefire.
Paris claimed that their forces have destroyed four Yemeni drones in the Gulf of Aden that were heading towards a European Union naval operation, as Israel's invasion edges closer to a larger regional conflict. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A genocide is taking place in Gaza amid international silence. 15 Italian lawmakers who have recently visited the Rafah border in southern Gaza say an international reaction to avoid the aggravation of a humanitarian catastrophe in Rafah is desperately needed. They had left Italy for Egypt earlier this week with a goal to provide the Italian government with a testimony of the tragedy the Palestinians are experiencing as a result of Israel's crimes. Here is what they have to say about their experience.
Israel's cruel actions in Gaza are based on a clear genocidal intent. Refusing to allow water, food, medicine, and humanitarian supplies is equivalent to exterminating an entire population. Palestine must be immediately recognized as a state, and a reconstruction plan is urgently needed.
We saw thousands of trucks waiting at the border with Rafah, as farming is ravaging Gaza. Trucks are not allowed to go through because Israel is stopping them. We are certain that a humanitarian catastrophe is unfolding.
We have met Palestinian kids with their legs amputated in an Italian hospital in Cairo as Israel continues to commit crimes against humanity in Gaza. There is only one person who should be held accountable for the situation there, Netanyahu and his regime.
So far, the Italian government has unrelentingly sided with the Israeli regime. This despite hundreds of pro-Palestine demonstrations having been held across Italy over the past months. Meanwhile, on Saturday, a new demonstration was organized here in Rome by a string of humanitarian organizations, charities, and unions calling for an immediate end to Israel's genocide in Gaza. The initiative is also calling on Italian institutions to protect the right to freedom of assembly and freedom of expression and opinion in Italy.
It is essential to protect and promote dissenting voices. The use of force by our authorities will not stop the course of history. Upholding the rule of law is the only way to ensure peace.
On Saturday, Rome was once again flooded by tens of thousands of people from across the country calling on the international community to hold Israel accountable for its systematic violations under international law and to continue supporting the United Nations agency aiding Palestinian refugees, UNRWA. A demonstration in solidarity with Palestinians was also held in Milan. Max Civili, Rome.
Supporters of Palestine gathered outside South Korea's Seoul Central Mosque to demand a change in policy toward Israel following news of another massacre of innocent civilians in war-torn Gaza.
The unconditional support of Israel should stop, and that we need to start refunding UNRWA and letting aid trucks come into Gaza.
Palestinians are now starving as the U.S. continues sending Israel ammunition, despite the protests of many Americans.
It's really immoral to be sending weapons to a state or country that is killing people in cold blood and is committing a genocide.
Not enough aid is reaching Gaza, with deliveries chaotic and even deadly.
Opening the Rafah crossing and allowing relief supplies into Gaza is simply the bare minimum the Egyptian government can do.
South Korea expressed only deep concern.
Even though information is going all over the world showing that countless women and children are being massacred in the Gaza Strip and Palestine, they remain silent. And we also condemn the silence of these governments.
Many suggest both Israeli and U.S. leaders share responsibility as the bloodshed in Gaza ever mounts. South Korea's alliance with the United States and its reliance on oil states, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, impact Seoul's policies. South Korea and Israel have engaged in millions of dollars of arms trade. Seoul also abstained from a UN vote condemning Israel over its Gaza genocide, seeking some kind of middle ground. This one of dozens of protests here since Israel's genocide began focused on the desperate need to get aid to Palestinians sheltering in Rafah and to open the Egyptian border. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The head of Hamas Political Bureau has urged leaders and scholars of the Muslim world to take political, diplomatic, and legal measures to halt the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Ismail Haniyeh added that pressure must be mounted on countries that support Israel to force the regime to immediately and unconditionally end its onslaught on Gaza. He urged increased humanitarian assistance to be delivered to Gaza ahead of Ramadan, as people will need more food, medicine, and shelter during the holy month. Haniyeh called on Muslim countries to take steps to prosecute Israel, to expose the regime's crimes, and to isolate it politically and diplomatically over its war crimes. He asserted that Israeli crimes will not deter Palestinians from continuing resistance until they regain their freedom and independence in a sovereign state, with Al-Quds as its capital. The conference is held in Syria's capital to mobilize legal efforts to prepare necessary documents and evidence in order to prosecute Israeli leaders before the International Court of Justice. Ibrahim Wahdi has more from Damascus.
Under the title, Truth in Document, Syria's Arab Nation League launched the Legal Action Conference to defend our people in Gaza in the Syrian capital, Damascus. A team of international law specialists from different nationalities have joined efforts to persecute the Israeli regime in the international law forums as the months-long Israeli war continues amid international silence.
Today marks the beginning of the international legal action to document the crimes against Gaza in several stages. The first stage includes launching a website to document and archive Israeli war crimes, including Israeli confessions and corresponding legal studies. The second stage will take place with human rights organizations accredited to the Human Rights Council and a group of experts in international law from Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, South Africa, Belgium, and Norway.
The legal team that attended the conference confirmed that they will document Israeli violations and crimes, accompanied by legal studies to present them to the international community and demand to hold this criminal regime accountable in accordance with the principles of international law.
The importance of this event lies in ensuring bold and very important action at this time to document the crimes of the Zionist enemy against our brothers in Gaza. From a legal perspective, this is a very necessary action and a natural reaction that should have been done a long time ago. It is not enough to shout slogans, but we must gather legal documents to carry out real actions.
Our presence should not be limited to the courts created by the United States, which usually hold accountable those who say no to the United States or Israel. We thought of launching a website through this conference to document Zionist crimes since the occupation of Palestine in 1948 until today, in order to prepare legal demands and actions on these crimes at international scale.
Participants agreed that protecting the resistance is among the highest priorities of the legal specialist team through protecting its environment and the right of the Palestinians to their land. They asserted that they have also prepared measures to file lawsuits to hold accountable those who normalized relations with the Israeli regime.
This conference aims to emphasize the importance of legal and media actions in documenting the crimes of the Zionist regime, which have decimated the life in war-torn Gaza. The conference highlighted the grave violations of Palestinians' human rights through Israel's impunity and the silence of international community. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
And that does for this additional World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we went beneath the world's oceans to discover what has happened to the millions of tons of chemical weapons that have been dumped in the sea since the early 20th century. Now, as we have entered the 21st century and forgotten the days of the war, real time bombs are ticking under the seas of the planet. The Baltic Sea, the most polluted sea in the world, is rife with tons of highly toxic and explosive cocktails of chemical weapons inherited from two world wars, which threaten us today. Stay with us for the second part of the documentary as we go across the Atlantic to see the legacy of two world wars all around the United States coast.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up, and therefore we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive. We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist fishing vessels that have caught chemical combinations. So that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep-sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
We're in Lahnfurt, Germany. This is where the pipeline comes out of the Baltic Sea, and this is where the gas enters the European gas grid. The munitions issue meant that we had to do extensive detailed surveys. Once the alignments of the pipelines were defined, we then did the detailed munitions surveys. We did very high resolution side-scan sonar surveys, magnetometer surveys, and bathymetric surveys. And then within the installation corridor, so that's where the pipeline could touch the seabed, we did gradiometer survey works and visual inspections. And out of those, we identified over 400 munitions along the pipeline route. To allow us to have a safe corridor, we had to clear munitions within plus or minus 25 meters of the Nord Stream pipelines. So prior to the installation, we cleared munitions through using detonation techniques in the Gulf of Finland and in Russia. And in Germany, we lifted the munitions that we found close to the route. We had located a number of chemical munitions, and these were avoided.
The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on a investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s of barrels and barrels of mustard gas and lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where the records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't had any idea where they would be.
In the wake of Bull's investigations, the U.S. Congress called upon the Army to increase its efforts to locate dump sites. That work goes on today at the very facility where the U.S. produced its massive chemical weapons arsenal.
My work here has been mostly archival research on when we started, why we started, where we started dumping chemical munitions. White binders are pretty much all of the information that in the last 5 years we've been able to find on the chemical weapons disposals and some conventional in U.S. waters. It is putting a puzzle together in many, many instances because you find a piece of correspondence, say, that Edgewood's got some 4.2 white phosphorus rounds and some 4.2-inch mustard-filled rounds. We need to dispose of them. They are unsafe, unserviceable. They cannot be reconditioned. So you've got that piece of paper, okay. But all of a sudden you get a piece of paper out of Norfolk Navy. I go, wait a minute, now I know what they did with them. And whoa, we've got the boat. So we go and we find the logbook. And hopefully the captain put in the latlongs. You know, how long did it take him and when he went back to shore. Anytime that you find something that matches up, it's like I can only equate it maybe to a jigsaw puzzle with 10,000 pieces. How long would that take you to put together? I don't know. Don't want to find out.
William Brankovitz was the first to chart U.S. chemical weapons dumping at foreign and domestic sites for the U.S. Defense Department in the 1980s.
Part of the problem at the end of the war was we captured a great number of those chemical weapons, as did the Russians. And we all share some of that legacy today. Some of those chemical weapons were returned to the United States for exploitation to be looked at and to be evaluated and tested. But the rest of it was, again, thought to be excess to anyone's needs. So a great many of those chemical weapons were taken out to sea and were sea disposed at the time. That pretty much continued right into the 1960s. In the 1960s, people became concerned about, is this really the way to get rid of chemical weapons? There were a series of chemical weapons disposals that were planned at the end of the 1960s in an operation called Operation Chase. The last one was under a great deal of controversy. By that time, everyone had started to realize that there were potential problems. And so the Army asked the National Academy of Sciences in 1969 to take a look at this problem and do a study and see what the best way was of doing this disposal action. They issued it, and it basically said, due to the fact that we don't know completely how the fate of this material is resolved on the ocean floor, we recommend that you stop see disposing of chemical weapons. And we moved away at that point in time completely from ocean disposal of chemical weapons. I think about 2 years later, in 1972, there was a congressional act that made it illegal.
The Pentagon began a pilot program to study environmental effects off the coast of Hawaii, where it dumped tons of conventional and chemical munitions over the decades.
I think we've all learned things, that the ocean is not a garbage dump, and if you dump something into the ocean, it does have environmental effects. When you understand that, today we're taking a look to see what those effects are. We're looking at the fish. We're looking at the other biota in the sea to see what effect it has had to determine whether removal is an appropriate course of action. What is down there has been down there 30, 40, 50 or more years, in some cases 80 years. There's a lot of work the environment has done on these munitions. And that work has been to slowly dissolve them and absorb them. And when we're not finding an adverse impact to health, life, safety, leave in place is continuing to be the right solution. I'm not saying that we won't find a location where we make a different decision. But when we're using a science-based approach, we really want there to be an understanding of the effect on the environment, an understanding on the effect on people, and an understanding of what happens when we bring it up out of the water. Is that really the safest, most risk-averse manner of handling this?
The United States and Great Britain have extended official secrecy until 2017. And for the last 60 years, scientific research on chemical weapons in the sea and the dangers they pose has been limited because of this military control. Canada launched a big effort to dispose of chemical weapons during World War II. One retired Army mine clearing expert has combined environmental concern with an entrepreneurial approach and become a crusader for cleanup.
Good afternoon, I'm Wendy Bergfeld, and this is Bain Street. And on today's program, a conversation with Terry Long, a former military engineer and explosive ordnance disposal expert, more than 30 years experience, and he is sounding the alarm. Our conversation on today's edition of Main Street.
I was born in Sydney, Nova Scotia, and I grew up here. Cape Breton Island is an island. We have a big lake in the middle of it called the Bedore Lakes. It's a very beautiful island, pristine in some areas. When you start looking at the Bedore Lakes, there's actually five munition sites, and one is a chemical weapons disposal site from after the Second World War. Johnstown was used for a chemical weapons facility. Everything was secret. They didn't want people to know that this was actually being manufactured here. It was the same thing after the war when they started to look at decommissioning. It was basically just tear down the structures and leave it. And there was, again, no knowledge that it was a chemical weapons site, so nobody would suspect anything there at all. So when I started looking at that, I started feeling compelled that I had to do something to protect their lake. And then when I started looking outside of Nova Scotia, again, I was getting shocked. All these different munition sites all along the eastern seaboard, all along the west coast of Canada, and all around the world, from the Baltic Sea to the Sea of Japan. The first thing I did is I did a Canadian Senate hearing, and I took the First Nations of Wagobok with me so we could actually talk about it from the perspective of First Nations, as them being the keeper of Mother Earth. So at the Senate hearing, we discussed the different sites, what some of the contaminants are. Two recommendations came out. The first was the United Nations should have an international conference to address sea dump munitions. The second was is we needed to develop a stakeholders group that encompassed everybody to actually look at the effects from the munitions. So what happened is, because there was no international conference, I developed the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions, and that became the international platform for munitions.
My name is Albert Marshall, and I am from the Moose Clan. I am from Mi'kmaq, the Mi'kmaq territory. back during the war, we used to see these planes going back and forth. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of bombs dumped into the Bordeaux Lakes. Harry Long informed me of what compounds that these bombs had, because in a lot of our observations, we used to see a lot of unusual lesions in some of these aquatic life. Personally, I've had 6-7 members of my immediate family that have died from various strains of cancer. And even as we speak, I have a granddaughter at the Children's Hospital in Halifax with cancer. Bordeaux Lakes has been a lifeline for our people for so long. Factoring our 7 generations, we have to also ensure that our future generations will also have the same privileges as we have today.
Canadian authorities had never admitted that chemical weapons were dumped in the Bordeaux Lakes, but they haven't denied it either, and for Terry Long, that silence speaks volumes. Concerns that dump sites cannot be cleaned up without injury to humans and damage to the environment has hindered such efforts. But Japanese officials, pushed by economic interests, decided to move ahead. They founded the first industrial program to clean up chemical weapons in the seas. Imperial Japan produced large quantities of weapons containing mustard gas and lewisite in the 1930s. They used them against civilians during the invasion of Manchuria in 1937, killing thousands. Poison gases were produced here at Okunoshima Island. The work was so secret the island was removed from Japanese maps during World War II. Today the island is called Bunny Island. The bombs in the Kanda port lie just 10 meters deep, and the Japanese government negotiated a contract with Kobelco, a giant steel corporation, to clear the weapons and destroy them. Kobelco technology is beginning to interest other countries like the United States, Belgium, and France. The Kanda experience and Kobelco's cutting-edge research with underwater robotics demonstrates safe cleanups can be conducted in depths of up to 150 meters safely for humans and the environment. 1 million tons of chemical weapons lie in the depths of the seas. Some have been there for more than 70 years now. Most countries clearly don't want to take responsibility for cleaning up their own weapons. And many other munitions belong to no country. For example, who will pay for the weapons made by Germany during World War II and dumped by the Allies? The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which won the 2013 Nobel Peace Prize, has a mandate to end the spread of chemical weapons around the globe. Since 1992, 190 countries have signed the convention prohibiting chemical weapons. However, the OPCW has never taken a stance on the issue of munitions dumped in the sea. Terry Long, with the support of Baltic state officials, brought his group and the problem to The Hague last spring to urge the organization to support cleanup efforts.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everybody here today to this side event at the LIPA room. My name is Terence Patrick Long. I'm the chairman of the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions. What is desperately needed is ownership and leadership and the coordination of international efforts to adequately address sea dump chemical munitions.
We think that time is really ripe to act, because weapons are surfacing and calling for action. We are truly convinced that the member state of the OPCW will finally listen to us.
Every now and then people are asking us, is the leakage increasing or not, or is the environmental damage ongoing? we cannot answer them with the degree of certainty we would like to have.
The worldwide dumping of sea-dump chemical munitions by the international community was a mistake. We all seriously need to accept the obvious, that substances that are too toxic to touch with the ungloved hand has no place in our marine environment.
It's urgent that scientists be free to continue their research. The military secrecy imposed by the Allies since the Potsdam Conference in 1945 must be lifted. This is essential to effectively evaluate the risks these weapons pose to man, the environment, and the food chain.
That the states involved in creating this disaster will finally clean up and take responsibility for their previous actions before it is too late and the legacy of the world wars takes its toll on the world's next generation. Let's wait and see. And that's it for this week. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
نقيم الدين ولا تتفرق فيه.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
كتاب الله.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثتُ لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. And this is your host, Brother Mustafa. On this show, we discuss Islamic ethics and morality and what steps we can take towards reaching God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. One of the steps that I've talked about is correcting our understanding, is correcting our thoughts and way of thinking. One of the most important steps and ways and things that we can do is to correct our understanding of Tawheed. Tawheed means, you know, it's normally translated as monotheism or our belief in the oneness of God. And it's unfortunately in today, in the era that we're living in, it's one of the most important topics that a lot of us unfortunately don't always pay attention to. You know, one of the scholars that I was listening to, he was saying that in a lot of the youth today, not only in the youth, in a lot of people, if we could only correct their way of thinking about Tawheed, so many other things will correct themselves. Right? So what does it mean really when we're talking about Tawheed or monotheism? This is the, you know, a lot of, for example, the question that we hear, for example, you know, why did, for example, Allah create this world? What is the purpose of this world? These are all questions related to Tawheed. They're all related to understanding that oneness of God. Before I really, you know, talk more about specifically about, you know, what is Tawheed and monotheism, a big part of that is, of course, is purifying ourselves and our heart, right? When we purify ourselves, one of the biggest steps that we can take towards understanding God, one of the barriers that comes in the way is, unfortunately, it's our own sins. When we are committing sins, you know, we are then many times looking for excuses or ways or justifications for committing those sins. And what does, you know, our mind, or what does, you know, Satan, what does he do? He attacks our way of thinking about God. He makes us question our life and our purpose and why we are here. And many times, you know, we feel that, you know, we can't find answers to these questions. And it becomes, for example, a justification to continue to commit those sins. So the step that's directly related to understanding monotheism, it's actually is to stop committing sins, right? When we stop committing sins, it allows us to really, first of all, it frees up your time, it frees up your mind, and allows you to truly focus on what you want. Much of our time and focus, for unfortunately, is sometimes spent on committing sins. And what you realize is when you stop committing those sins, you will start receiving, you know, that light from God, that guidance from God. God says in the Holy Quran that He will not guide, you know, the oppressors. And sometimes we think that this is maybe referring to the enemies of God, you know, it's referring to those disbelievers that God is saying He won't guide them. When in reality, this verse applies not only to those people, but it also applies to those people who believe in God. Then even when you're receiving God's guidance, we may end up ignoring it, right? So one of the critical steps that you can take in understanding God and monotheism is to stop committing sins. And this will help you to purify yourself and to start receiving that guidance from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that we all very much are in need of. God says that He is the guide, that He takes this responsibility upon Himself. He says that if you act upon what I say in the Quran, then I will guide you. What more can we want in life other than getting that direct guidance and the direct knowledge from God Himself in our lives, where He protects us, where He saves us, and where He impacts and influences even our way of thinking? We have to go for a quick break, and once we're back, we'll continue talking about this very important topic.
Your mercy, Your love is all I need. It's all I need. It's all I need. All I need. Oh, 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 oh. All I need to be all I need. And I know that You see how much You need. Oh, 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 oh. Cause Your love is all I need to be all I can be. And I know that You see how much You mean to me. Cause Your love is all I need.
what you mean to me.
Your love is all I need.
When we're talking about understanding Tawheed or monotheism, what we're really talking about is understanding reality. Right? We're talking about understanding existence. Because all of existence itself is a manifestation of God's attributes. It is directly related to God Himself. God says that He is closer to us than our jugular veins in the Holy Quran. One of the interpretations or understandings of these verses is that He is part of, in a way, He is manifesting Himself through existence, right? Today's questions that many people have are very much related to philosophy. And the topic of philosophy is existence and its relationship with God. And to sort of drive this point in or emphasize this point in even more, there's a small anecdotal, you know, story about a person that wakes up on a ship one day. And he's completely lost all of his memory. You know, he wakes up on the ship in a room. You know, he comes out of the room onto the ship and he's on the board of the ship. And he sees there's, you know, he's in the ship is in the middle of the sea. And there's different people on this boat. You know, he sees a bunch of people playing games. And then suddenly he sees that, you know, a force pulls a person off the ship and drops him into the sea. And he sees people suddenly getting worried. He sees suddenly people crying for this person. But then they go back to playing their games. So he goes up to someone and he says, you know, hey, you know, where are we right now? What's going on here? You know, what's the ship? Who am I? What are we doing here? And these people, they kind of look at him and they say, you know, don't worry about those things. Why don't you just come and play these games that we're playing, right? So, of course, this analogy or the story is very much related to us, right? Sometimes we're, you know, this ship is this world, and the games that people are playing are the games that we play in this world. Those could be the games of politics, those could be the games that we, of our jobs and our daily lives. And we don't necessarily spend time thinking about those people that are being pulled out of this world, those people that are dying. Our worry and our, you know, we should be worried about understanding about, you know, where we're from, where we are, and where we're going. Imam Ali even says this in one of his sayings. He says, you know, may God's mercy be upon the person who knows where he's from, where he is, and where he will be going. So understanding, you know, and connecting to God is very, very closely related to our understanding of these sort of three aspects and understanding our life. And this requires time. This requires purification. This requires us to have a good routine and consistency in our life. And it definitely requires us to not be committing sins. When we're committing sins, then we are playing those games and we are unable to then focus on these questions. Spirituality, Islamic spirituality, leads to self-realization and realization of God. For example, that comes from another saying, a very famous narration that we have, is that the one who understands him or herself will come to know God. So monotheism and Tawheed are directly related to every aspect of our life. They're related to understanding ourselves, and it's related to understanding our existence and why we are here. I hope this was a episode which allowed you to sort of think and ponder. I don't necessarily feel like I should be giving all the answers on my own understanding. I feel this is a journey that all of us have to take ourselves, that we have to spend time pondering and thinking about these things. So please pray for me and yourself for guidance, and may Allah help us in truly understanding Him and ourselves. Thank you so much for listening. Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, He knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, He knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, He knows.
Oh,
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.